Yes, on the Shoresh website.
Okay.
It's at this point probably 150,
175
okay. classes.
On the Shoresh website. Yeah. It's under programming and then adult education. And then for this particular class, there's the flyer, the super
hero
flyer. If you click on the flyer, it will take you to a place where it says prior, prior classes. You click on that, and it'll take you to another page, and it'll have all of the classes for this class, and then it'll have all the classes, all of them tabbed. It took him.
There's a lot out there.
Yeah.
I've been doing this for a while. You made it in. Great. Excellent.
Hi, Sam.
Yay, thank you, Alan.
Good job.
She can't see us, but we are.
I can see them. There's a whole group here wishing you, hey. Okay. That being said, though, and I think that I don't know if it was the title. I really don't. I'm hoping that it was mostly Pam nudging you to come, followed by a guilt trip that I gave you. So between the two of us, I'm glad that you all decided to come and join us. Obviously, as we get closer to the holiday, I always feel compelled to talk about it. It's an important milestone in our calendar. So Passover is coming. I know I shouldn't say it. It conjures up for some people terrible feelings about getting ready and how much work needs to be done, the briskets that need to be cooked, etc. But it's a reality, folks. I try to find something new every year. I had a teacher once who asked such a funny question. He said, why is it that every single year, if you go into a Judaic store, there are new Haggadahs? How can there be new Haggadahs? We've been using the same. But every year, there's a new Haggadah out there. Why? Because there's another insight and there's another thing. It's never ending. There's so much that we can learn. So I try to approach every single holiday with that mindset of what is something new? What's something that we can learn that maybe we hadn't thought about? So in the context of our discussion of where we're talking about heroes and villains, there's no fancy shtick here. It's pretty straightforward. We know who the heroes are. We know who the villains are. I want to share with you that the hero tonight, it's a hero. We did two in a row with villains. Just feeling three would be like tic-tac-toe. That's just like, we can't do that. We need a hero every now and then. And is it loud enough? Can you hear? Okay. So the hero is Moses. The hero is Moses. But I want to focus on something that I'm not sure is given enough attention or perhaps is totally overlooked. What do we know about? We know the Moses who comes on the scene as this leader who God gave this mission to go take the Jewish people out of Egypt. And for the most part, you'd be right. However, if you really take the time to follow him as from when he's born to when he takes over that mantle of leadership, you're given very little. I mean, like, really, almost nothing. We all know the beginning of the story. The story is that he's born as a preemie. His mom is able to hide him because there's a decree at that time that all males were to be cast into the sea because they had a vision at that point that a savior was going to come for the Jewish people. And Pharaoh said, I'm no part of this. All male boys, all throw him into the sea. Fine. So she's able to hide him for a few months. And then she has no choice. So she puts him in a basket. Puts him in a basket. Puts him in the sea.
In the bulrush, right?
And floats him down the river. Floats him down the Nile. Who's standing watching? We talked about this in our very first class of our hero is Miriam, his sister. She's watching to make sure that he's okay. He's saved by the daughter of Pharaoh, ironically, right? And she takes him in and he grows up in the palace. That's story number one. That's all we know. The very next story in the Torah is he goes outside the palace and he sees an Egyptian beating up a Hebrew. just stop and ask yourself, how old is he at this time? He's not two. He's not three. We can guess.
Teenage years.
It's not, you'll see that there are gaps, serious gaps. But fine. He goes out, and what does he do with that Egyptian?
He kills him.
Kills him, buries him in the sand, and he thinks he's okay. Next story. The very next day, Moses comes out of the palace, and this time he sees two Jews fighting. Two Hebrews are fighting. And he tries to intervene. He looks shocked.
I did not know that.
Okay, are you part of the Jewish people? Have we? Like, seriously?
Have we met?
It's like, come on. Right? Two Jews are fighting. Moses tries to intervene, and they say to him, what? You're going to do to us what you did to the Egyptian yesterday? Well, very Jewish response. So fine. So Moshe realizes that his goose is cooked. He cannot stick around because they're going to snitch to Pharaoh. So he has to run. He becomes a fugitive long before, what's his name? Harrison Ford, right? He becomes a fugitive and he has to flee the country of Egypt. And he goes to another country, a neighboring country called Midian. Okay. How old is he? Don't know. Okay, let's keep going. The very next story, he comes into Midian. He's fleeing for his life, and he goes to the watering hole. That's what we would call a bar today, okay? And he's there, but that's where the shepherds are getting water for their sheep. And he sees some female shepherds that are being picked on by some of the male shepherds. Super Moshe to the rescue. And sure enough, he says, hey, not appropriate. Saves the girls. Not only that, but he provides drink to all of their animals. They go running home. Their father, and who knows his name?
Jethro.
Oh. Very good. Right? You know the rock band? Jethro Tull. Okay, fine.
He looks over there.
Right? At least maybe somebody got it there. Yeah, okay.
I did.
Thank you. Jethro, right? Yisro, he's called in Hebrew. So Yisro says to them, what are you doing home so early? And they said, some Egyptian dude just helped us. He goes, oh, why didn't you invite him in? So, of course, he's invited in, gets to know the family. He marries one of his girls by the name of Tzipora. Next story. I'm literally reading it to you verse by verse. The very next story. Moses is out shepherding his father-in-law's flock, and he comes to the
burning
bush. And in this burning bush, God comes to him in a vision and says, you're the man. You're the one. I want you to go down to Egypt. He goes, not me. And they have the whole back and forth discussion why he doesn't feel worthy of it. God says, I'm telling you, trust me. I got the whole scoop. You're the man. You got to do this. Fine. Moses goes down, and that's where our story begins. That's it. That's all we know about his early years. How old is he when he goes down to take the Jewish people out? I'm curious.
49.
That's a pretty exact number. I like it. 49. What do you think? Take a guess. Take a while. What picture do you have in your head?
No, just when he goes back. When he goes back to Pharaoh, you mean? When he goes back to Egypt? That
mm-hmm. after to lead the Jews out. How old is he?
30. I'm guessing.
You waited all this time. Give me an answer. Come on.
59.
Anybody else?
Because they're always doing amazing things. At really old ages.
They're doing amazing things at really old ages.
I was
59.
Say, like,
yeah, right.
227.
Okay. No. That's a little too old. Moses doesn't live that long. The correct answer is, I would venture to say, about 79.
I'll tell you
where I'm getting this from. I'll explain it. It's very simple. How old is Moses when he dies?
120.
Oh, how many years does he lead the Jewish people? How many years does he lead the Jewish people in the desert? 40 years, which means the Exodus, he's how old?
80.
He's 80. The plagues, which precede the Exodus, are about 1 year.
Oh,
from beginning to end.
A year
from beginning to end is about a year.
It was
79 when he gets back in. So I'll go so far as to say he's probably 78. when this whole story of the burning bush. Right? So what do we know for the first 78 years of this dude's life? Not much.
So
and wait, to make matters worse.
When he went back to Egypt. That's
give or take.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Got it.
I'm only working backwards.
Got it. Got it.
But here's the bigger question. What?
So Hollywood has it all wrong.
It ain't the first time Hollywood has it all wrong. Yeah. Maybe one day we'll sit down and we'll critique Charlton Heston's role as Moses in that story,
the
Ten Commandments.
For the secular girl who didn't even know it was supposed to last 8 days until she was 25.
What was supposed to last 8 days?
Passover.
Oh, I thought it was Hanukkah. I have no idea what you're talking about.
No, isn't it supposed to last 8 days? I've been eating masa.
It's supposed to be seven, but it's okay. Oh. But you should keep eight. That's okay.
We do eight here.
So, but 1 second. But seriously, from a historical perspective, the Torah, I say this all the time, the Torah is not a history book. Because if it is, it's terrible. Major gaps in stories. The Torah only gives us information that is relevant for us to know the rights and wrongs, character development. What is absolutely pertinent for me in 2022 to know whether Moses wore that kind of clothing or this kind of clothing. He was very into his fashion. I have no idea. It has no relevance. So the Torah doesn't tell me, which begs the question. The stories that we are told then are relevant. So
I have a hard time with the Leviticus and all the chapters about what you wear in the temple.
I don't wear. I wish I did.
Well, Leviticus.
The priests.
The priests were in the temple, or what happened with this week's Torah portion with Aaron and his son.
Lots of very important stuff that has relevance. It does. You have to dig a little deeper, but it's there. But the question is, these are the five stories we're told about his entire upbringing till he's ready to take on this big role. Why are we told these stories? What I will share with you, and I really think this is the theme that runs through all of him. This is his character. I'm going to teach you a phrase. It's four Hebrew words. Nosei be'ol im chavero. Literally means carrying the burden with his friend. What we would say nowadays is, right, you lend a shoulder to help someone, right? You put it on your shoulder and you schlep it together with them. This is an expression of someone who has care and concern for someone else. I'm going to go even farther. It's not just that I care, but I do something about it. I can have a great quality, a great trait, and I feel bad. I feel bad for people. I take things seriously, right? I can watch all of the chick flicks and I'll cry. I'll cry because, you know, it's not manly, but I'll do it. Right? I feel. But do I do anything about it? Am I going to be moved in a more serious vein? We're watching unfold in front of our eyes a horrific world tragedy. We're watching this. What are we doing about it? Okay, the mere fact that maybe I take time in my day and I utter a prayer. Maybe I donate money. Those are all good things, but I have to do something. This concept of being able to feel, actually feel someone else's pain and help them is this trait of Moshe. And I'm going to show you, let's go back to the stories. And you'll see what's amazing in all of this. Let's start with the beginning. He comes out of the palace. Obviously, his birth, he doesn't have much of a say in it. It is what it is, right? His mother and his sister and his brother, and they all play very vital roles. But when he starts, let's see what we have. Here's what the Torah tells us, okay? And I'm literally, the daughter of Pharaoh, I'm up to that part of the story. So he's 3 months old. The daughter of Pharaoh says, go. The girl went, summoned the boy's mother. Pharaoh's daughter said to take this boy, nurse him for me. I will give your pay. So the woman took the boy and nursed him. Next sentence. The boy grew up and she brought him to the daughter of Pharaoh and he was a son to her. Moses, after being nursed by his mother, I'm assuming best case scenario was 2 years, right? He didn't nurse till he was a teenager. Mm-hmm. Okay. So a couple of years.
Or maybe a little longer, but yeah.
He's not maybe a teenager. Okay. Why four? Okay. I'm guaranteed to because I don't have the patience, right? So fine. Four. Fine. Four. And now. So now he's back in the palace. Okay. Please note the terminology. The boy grew up and she brought him to the daughter of Pharaoh and he was a son to her. She called his name Moses, as she said, for I drew him from the water. Okay. He's in the palace. 4 years old. 2 years old. It happened in those days that Moses grew up and went out to his brethren and observed their burdens. And he saw an Egyptian man striking a Hebrew man of his brethren. He turned this way and that, saw there was no man. So he struck down the Egyptian and hit him in the sand. The very beginning of that sentence is bothersome. It happened in those days that Moses grew up. Did I not just say that in the previous verse? I'll read it to you in case you missed it. The boy grew up, and she brought him to the daughter of Pharaoh, and he was a son to her. Yada, yada, yada. It happened in those days that Moses grew up.
That we grew up more.
Okay, maybe got older. Okay.
Would the first one be weaned?
Maybe. Mm-hmm. But watch. I did you a disservice. I paused in a place I shouldn't. Watch how I read the verse a little bit more precisely. It happened in those days that Moses grew up and went out to his brethren and observed their burdens.
That's another level of grown up.
Now we're talking. We're not talking about age. Yeah, I'm sure that's part of it. But there's a whole new level of growing up. There's a maturity. Mm-hmm. There's a maturity. And what does the Torah identify of his growth, of his maturity? What is it focused on?
Taking on the burden of.
He sees someone else's trouble. Remember, this guy is growing up in the lap of luxury. Mm-hmm. He's in the palace. He has no reason to even go out of the palace. And even if he does, so he sees it. Okay. Well, I'm not there. You know, best of luck to you, man.
So why did he know they were his brethren?
Great question. Great question. Who's his mother?
Daughter of his adopted mother?
No, his real mother.
Oh, right.
Yosheba. Yeah. Right? Yocheved,
yeah,
right?
But how does he know that? Because
he doesn't know that.
Yeah.
Why doesn't he know that?
Why would he know
that? Didn't he just not? Who did he nurse from?
Well, he didn't know who he was nursing from.
From Yocheved. Yeah, but that doesn't mean he knew that was his mother.
What do you think Yocheved did with him all day?
Okay.
So we're dealing with. Let's take a step back. Let's take. 100%. Okay, so let's take a step back for a moment. It's amazing how I love to watch in a group. I will get pounded by the fact that, well, Moses, I mean, come on, you can't compare him to us. Moses was so blessed. Moses had conversations with him, and we put him on a pedestal, and we say he can't relate to us. And then I try to present him in a normal manner, and you're like, well, he's just a normal kid. How would he possibly know that? I can't win.
But
Moses, there's no question in my mind. I can't prove it to you. I can't prove it. But there's not even a question in my mind that Moses is a blessed child. There is no question that he is gifted. He is definitely
gifted.
Okay. He is extremely gifted. Eliane, think about it for a second.
As an adoptive mother, I'm sitting here going,
I don't know what means, but I can tell you this much.
It's really hard to relate that he would just sort of know that they were his brethren automatically.
I didn't say that.
Would tell him. Well, I could see somebody telling him, but we don't have the whatever amount of years between the time he was weaned and brought back to the palace and when he went out. So we don't know that he was told that.
So if you listen, if you give me the chance to explain, as I said, I can't prove it to you. But if you look at the body of work of an individual for 120 years, we can agree on one thing. He's gifted. Above and beyond any human being any of us have ever met.
Well, I
can prove. He's the only prophet in history who had a working relationship with God as he did. Can't deny that. He spoke with God better than any prophet ever and ever will be. So we're talking about a unique individual. I don't want to paint a picture that he's not human. He is 100% human. He was born from a woman, flesh and blood, but he was gifted. There's no question. The way, that's mine. We're talking about a very gifted individual. I can't sit here and tell you, I know specifically that Yocheved taught him everything in Judaism. I can't do that. But do I feel confident thinking that Yocheved, who was Yocheved? Let's do it that way. Who was she? Other than the fact that it was Moshe's mother. Give me some information about her. Tell me what kind of person she is. Who is she married to? Give me a little background, folks. It's amazing.
Who is she married to?
Yeah. Who? Say it again.
Amram.
A-M-R-A-M. Amram. Tell me about Amram and Yocheved. Just a little snippet. Who are they in any of the stories?
I have no idea.
I know. That is part of our problem.
You don't want to make somebody feel foolish.
No.
There isn't much information.
The what?
Is there any information in the Torah about that?
Yes.
You told us something two times.
Oh, see, he listened. Amazing. I did say, Amram and Yocheved. Amram and Yocheved are the number one and number two leaders of the Jewish people at this moment.
No.
But
I thought there were 40.
How does the palace know that? Give it to Yocheved and allow him to live.
What? I understand the question.
Well, the decree is that all Jewish males need to be killed. The palace knows if they're sending it to the number one and number two Jewish family to be weaned. How does that? That seems difficult.
Well, he didn't. What? The Torah itself tells us that after the daughter of Pharaoh took him in, she says, "Shall his sister Miriam comes up to her and says, shall I go and summon for you a wet nurse from the Hebrew women who will nurse the boy for him, for you? Why? Why? There's no Egyptian wet nurses?
Well, it's a lower class type of thing, so.
There's nobody. Are you Egyptian?
Like for English royalty, they would take someone from working class to serve as wet nurses.
So let's even say that's the reason. But the fact of the matter is that the daughter of Pharaoh says, yes, I want him to be nursed by a Hebrew. Why?
She knew the edict, so she might have had a suspicion that this child that's hanging out in a basket in the middle of the Sea of Reeds
was a Hebrew.
And she's willing to risk her skin.
I never understood.
She's willing to risk her own skin. It's her father's decree.
But she could have a baby. She could sneak behind her father.
Which is exactly what she did.
Well, was her motivation. She wanted a baby more than she wanted to listen to her father. I mean,
great. So she gives it to a Hebrew woman. What do you think the Hebrew woman did? As a Hebrew woman, just nursed him? She was instilling within him, even at a very young age, the fact that he is Jewish.
So he doesn't realize that he's a Hebrew in his teens or as a young adult. You say
from the very beginning.
Old ways,
from the very beginning.
That he wasn't Pharaoh's son or grandson. Yeah.
The Prince of Egypt movie, by the way, got it worse than the Ten Commandments. Part of what is going on, and again, it's not a history book.
Right.
We're told certain pieces of information because it's relevant to understand how did he become who he became. We're taught that why couldn't he nurse from a non-Jewish woman?
Well, he could have.
But he didn't. So why is she going to seek specifically the Hebrew woman?
Because she knew the odds were that there was somebody who could be a wet nurse versus an Egyptian woman who did not recently have a baby.
She couldn't find a woman All of Egypt who recently had a child?
Well, maybe she
that's hard to believe.
That a Hebrew wet nurse is not going to go blabbing to
great
her father.
I believe that is that. I believe that is true.
They're going to be invested in.
But here's the bigger question: why do I need to know that? Who cares? The story doesn't seem to need that piece of information. Why do I need to know that?
If he knew all his life, and then presumably it affected his decisions in his life to some extent.
That is exactly my argument. That's why it's
here. You're welcome.
That's exactly my point. If the Torah is telling me that what seems to be a trivial piece of information that doesn't have impact for the next, then why tell it to me? The answer is, from my perspective, is that it is critically relevant to the story. Because the very next page is that he comes out of the palace and he observes, he went out to his brethren and observed their burdens.
I noticed that.
Yeah.
We noticed.
The brethren.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
We
are.
But how did he know
so,
they were the brethren?
Yeah, right. I thought he found out later. Okay.
I just thought it was an injustice. Yeah.
But you'll note, right, but I'll show you how great that point is. Because one could have argued and say, if that's where the story ends, it's an injustice of where it was an Egyptian, hitting a Jew.
Wait,
well, maybe he's not going to get involved. Maybe he's only going to get an injustice when his people are getting hurt.
Why couldn't
How about the next story? What's the very next story? It's two Jews. He can't stand an injustice, even if it's within his own people. You're talking about the character of an individual now. See, that's why these little stories or these little trivial pieces of information round out a picture. And that's why we're told it. Moshe has that character of feeling someone else's pain where there is an injustice. It could be a Jew. It could be a non-Jew. It doesn't matter. He runs away. That's the next story. He's a fugitive. Who is his main concern right now?
Himself.
It should be himself. He comes to the public area where people are, giving drink to their flock. And what does he see? He sees an injustice. If I were the fugitive, what the first thing I would say?
I'd run away.
Sayonara, baby. I'm out of here. I'm not getting involved with this. It's going to be in the local paper. Foreign hero from Egypt. That's like, why don't you just give a telegram straight to Pharaoh that I'm living here now?
Is there anything from other teachers like why he had to be a fugitive? I mean, if he's in the palace, he might have had carte blanche to kill an Egyptian.
Right. I can't say for sure, but hold that. You'll see as we get to the next part of the next story. Okay? I think that's a very relevant question. So he's running away for his life. And he comes and he sees an injustice. And he says, I have to do something. I feel the pain of these shepherds who are being picked on. And what does he do? He gets involved. He saves them. Not only that, he recognizes they probably had a rough day. Right? So what does he do? He gives the water to the sheep.
The shepherd said today was a very long week.
Today was a long week. Fine. So he goes and he's invited into Yisro's house, gets to meet his future wife, Tzipporah. And the next story has it that he's out shepherding the flock of his father-in-law. Okay, it's a nice story, right? You know anyone else who were shepherds in our history?
Joseph.
Jacob. Anyone else?
Isaac?
Nope.
Who? Abel?
No.
Yes.
Cain was.
Well, Cain was the shepherd, really.
Okay. Sorry.
Cain was the shepherd. No.
I'm sure there's
no Abel was the shepherd.
Cain killed Abel.
Yes.
Right. Cain was the hunter.
I mean, really bad. It's my
weak. And did Cain steal Abel's birthright?
Yeah, now, okay, now we're crossing wires.
That's Esau and Esau.
Yeah, Abel was the shepherd. Yeah, Cain was the farmer. Cain was the farmer, Abel was the shepherd. Okay? Abraham was a shepherd, King David was a shepherd, Rabbi Akiva was a shepherd.
Yes.
We have confirmation. Great. Yes. Why? Why is that like the chosen profession? You can say, oh, okay, because that's what it was. Yeah, but it again, ask the more important question is,
they nurture.
Care? That's the answer.
What was the question?
Wow. Question is, why is this the it, you find an inordinate number of leaders in the Jewish people whose early years are shepherds? Why? Because it's a proving ground.
Because they're leaders. They're leading the flock.
It's the other way around. They become leaders because they learn the trait of nurturing, of caring. Think about it. If you're a shepherd, you're going to go along and you're going to take the sheep out in a blazing hot sun, probably, because, you know, it's the Middle East, right? And blazing hot sun, you can take them to this place and take care of them, and then take them this place. Okay? At the end of a long, long day, you bring them all home safely, and you have to ward off the wolves and whatever else there. How many sheep are going to say thank you?
None.
Zero. How many? There's like almost, it's almost a thankless task, especially who is Moses shepherding for?
His father.
Not even his own. How did he find that burning bush in the first place?
He was shepherding.
There was a lost sheep.
Oh, the famous story that there was a sheep, that was one little sheep that ran away. The sheep ran away. Where did it go? It tried to find something to drink. It found a little brook somewhere. And Moshe chased after it. And Moshe, realizing that this needed something to drink, the sheep needed something, he, so to say, apologized. He apologized to the sheep to the extent of, I'm sorry, I didn't know that's what you wanted. He allowed the sheep to drink, and then he did what?
Carried it back.
He carried it back to the
where does this? I have no idea.
He carries the sheep
back. You told me
you
were going.
And he told you I was nursed by... You know,
yeah. Okay, don't give yourself that much credit. Sorry. It's your habit, first of all. Oh, but that's okay.
Isn't part of it also that shepherds are like out there? They have time to think deep thoughts.
Yes.
And
yes.
I'm like, I'm not being
You're
funny.
100% correct. You're right. That is part of it.
Who was the guy who played on the. That one's David.
That's David.
That's one thought.
Yeah.
Sat and played on its lute and thought great thoughts.
These are the five stories. All have the one message that Moshe has and was nurturing a trait of carrying the burden of someone else. Learning
to get to the burning bush where he's like, well, no.
He says, I don't feel worthy. Is that what you mean?
Why is that a contradiction to what I just said?
Because he didn't feel worthy of being able to carry.
Oh, I'm sorry. He's not arrogant like most of yours. What's wrong with the trait of humility?
Well, because he didn't say, I don't want it. He said, I'm not worthy of it.
And what was his last argument, by the way?
That he doesn't see.
That was not his last.
Oh, okay. Well,
God took care of that in one fell swoop by saying, who do you think gives man the ability to speak in the first place? Mm-hmm. I got you. Don't worry. You know what his last concern was?
I don't want to. Do it.
No.
I don't wanna go. No, I don't wanna. It
sounds like
I don't wanna. Fine.
People. What are we gonna do with you?
Sandy,
tell us.
Yes, everybody knows Sandy has the right answer already.
She said no.
She's looking it up.
Well, sure, we could look it up.
I would have to Google it.
Now.
He's just looking to verify.
He already
knows the answer.
I want to read it to you
because
you can say I made it up.
Wait a second. You taught Hebrew school.
Yeah, it was not in my curriculum. I only know the stories I know and what I saw.
What did you teach?
Here, Moses replied to Hashem, "Please, my Lord, I am not a man of words, since not since yesterday, nor since the day before yesterday, nor since you first spoke to your servant, for I am heavy of mouth and heavy of speech." That's your argument. Then Hashem said to him, "Who makes a mouth for man, or who makes one dumb or deaf or sighted or blind? Is it not I, Hashem? So now go, I shall be with your mouth and teach you what you should say." There goes that argument. Next words out of Moshe's mouth. He replied, "Please, my Lord, send through whomever you will send."
What?
That's pretty cryptic. Send through whomever you will send. Okay, let's see what Hashem's response is. The wrath of Hashem burned against Moses, and he said, "Is there not Aaron, your brother, the Levite? I know that he will surely speak. Moreover, behold, he is going out to meet you, and when he sees you, he will rejoice in his heart." Moshe's concern is, I'm the younger brother. I'm the younger brother. I'm not the first person in my family that you've had conversations and prophecy with. Have you not spoken with Aaron before? Which he had. Moses says, why send? What's the problem? Every time I make one step forward,
I don't recall God speaking to Aaron.
Well, that's not my problem. What am I supposed to tell you? There is a concept. God, I can show it to you from a later verse. A later verse that will give an indication that Aaron was a prophet.
Gotcha.
Okay. I can show you that Aaron's a prophet. Can we
agree on that?
Okay.
But I thought that, so God is saying that he'll take care of Moses.
Right. And then Moshe tries one last hurrah.
But I thought Aaron was the speaker.
That's, now you know where it comes from. That's where this takes place. It's in this conversation where God says, I know your concern is about Aaron's honor. You're the younger brother. I've used him for other prophecies. I get it, Moses. Don't worry. Not only will he not be insulted, not only will he not be hurt, he will be thrilled. He will rejoice the fact that you will be this leader. And if I can finish, right, the next words out of God's mouth is, right, when he sees you, he will rejoice in his heart. You shall speak to him and put the words in his mouth, and I shall be with your mouth and with his mouth, and teach you both what you are to do. He shall speak for you to the people, and it will be that he will be your mouth and you will be his leader. He'll do the talking. Don't worry. You have nothing to fear. But his big concern, what's my older brother going to feel about all this?
I get it from Hashem's response, but not from
Good. I'm with you.
I understand the answer. I don't understand.
I'm trying to give you years and years of homework, right? Of how to understand that phrase. But suffice it, you see that God's answering his question. And it's all about what's Aaron going to do. How does that fit into how Moshe phrased it is a very good question. And the commentaries grapple not what he said, but why he said it that way.
Okay.
It's a strange cryptic way to say it.
Okay.
Why didn't
God
he just say
it that way?
No,
why?
Moshe. Why did Moshe say it that way? God's pretty clear.
Who you will. Or...
Right.
Okay.
But it's clear that his concern was all about Aaron. Again, every part of this man's life, from the very beginning, through his upbringing, through his experiences to become a leader, it was built on one premise. Is he going to have this trait of care and concern for others and do something about it? Watch an injustice, bad enough, but is he going to do something to try to stop it? Feel and shoulder the pain of someone else.
Okay. But how did Moses know that Aaron was his brother?
What's that?
What?
Nothing. I'm just talking to him. Sorry.
I mean, we get that he was weaned and indoctrinated by Yochevet, and then he's in the court, and then he goes, and then he gets married, and he goes to the burning bush, and he has this conversation. But where in there does he learn that, are we supposed to just assume he knew and Aaron was his brother because of his time before he went to the court.
How did he know that Aaron was his brother?
Yes. And I'm sitting here at 50 some odd years old, just now getting to answer that question.
Would Aaron have been living in the household?
In Yoshevet's household? Yeah. I would hope so, but I guess that's an assumption that
if he knows he's
Jewish and he knows that Yoshevet is his mother, then he knows that everybody that's in that household is family. Okay.
Well, how do we know he really means brother? I mean, blood brother. I mean, you refer to other Jews as my brethren, so why would we absolutely assume that they're blood related?
Other than the fact that the Torah calls him his brother and calls Miriam his sister?
Yeah, but that's what he went out and among his brethren and saw them fighting, and they weren't his brothers or sisters. So how do you know when he needs brethren? And
or
when
what
he
is
doesn't?
The argument of the Midrash that gets us there? I don't know. It's being very heretical tonight.
I don't know.
I think brethren is, I mean, if the translation is brethren versus brother, they're two different things.
What do you mean? One is plural and the other one is singular. I mean, really, we've always assumed that they're brothers, but when you raise a valid question like, where's, how do we know brothers, they have at least one common parent, maybe two, how do we know that?
But it's a historical question, and again,
I'm not expecting an answer, I'm just saying there's a possibility they weren't blood brothers, that they were just co-Jews.
I think that it would say one of his brethren, as opposed
in
to
the genealogy part. It's not in the part that we're studying, but when it goes through the genealogy of the family, it says Amram and Yocheved had Aaron, Moshe, and Miriam.
Okay.
Those are the three children that are listed in the genealogy section. Let's see if I can find that. Mm. Hold on.
I know that it says that.
The white wine is in the fridge if you're looking for that.
Okay.
On the door.
Vayikach Amram es Yocheved dodoso lo liisha, and Amram took Yocheved as a wife. Vatelid lo, and she bore for him es Aaron the es Moshe, Aaron and Moshe. And then a little later on, it brings Miriam in as well. So it says pretty emphatically that Yocheved had these children, Aaron, Moshe, and Miriam.
But why did she give away Moshe?
Because there was a decree that all...
Newborn. Not Aaron.
Aaron's 3 years older than Moshe.
So, yeah, so I figured that was there.
We don't know.
Sorry,
you weren't
supposed
to hear that. Stop it.
Being
don't know.
Okay.
But it does say 3.
Okay. So
he
was 81.
83. Wait. 81 when what?
78,
81
is 3 years later. So,
yes,
at
the burning bush.
Yeah.
Yeah. The way the Torah phrases it, Moshe was 80 when he led the people out, and Aaron was 83.
But when they're meeting, and Aaron will be happy to see him, theoretically, Moshe's 78.
Right. That's correct.
The vision of these.
Right. That doesn't change.
These people, you know, schlepping through the desert. The ancient, you know, it's like all
I just
of
said,
all
I
of
my
history.
My
it's like going to school uphill in the snow both ways.
I don't know. I'm looking forward to getting to be that age.
Well, you got a lot of people taking care of you.
I hope not. I hope I'll be nice and spry then still.
At 120?
Certainly by 80.
I'm going to be at Ashby Ponds.
Yeah, that's near here. It's lovely.
As long as you're above ground, it's all good.
I don't know.
I mean, it's lovely for what it is. It's the most depressing thing in the world.
Okay.
It's like the shining.
That's the glass.
So that's the burning bush.
Okay. Yeah, thank you. And that's where
God says, you have the quality that's necessary. And that's why I choose you. He's being humble. He says, I don't think that I'm the right guy for this. I have this issue. I have that issue. Leadership needs other things. And God says, trust me, I know that you're the right guy for this.
Was there a third issue after about Aaron? So the first was about his...
Well, it wasn't the first. I mean, there were a few things. Moshe really declined. He didn't want any part of it at all. Now, I guess I'm already deep in stuff.
Go on. Jump in both feet.
The fact that Moshe declines to take the leadership, on the one hand, I don't think I'm wrong, is a sign of his humility. That's a great thing. But at some point, especially when the last hurrah, it says God got angry with him, right? God's anger, whatever, the wrath, right?
So he was burned by the wrath.
Right? Why? Humility. Because at some point, you have to say, okay,
you picked me.
I have what it takes. Fine. I don't see it, but if you, God, say it, okay, I got to trust you on this one. At some point, he should. And he is punished to some degree at some, for that lack of, okay, I can do this. There is a certain point of where you cross from being humble to you got to do it, though. You have to still do it. And he missed that window. So as we've said, every class, every hero is not perfect, and even villains have a positive side to them. Moshe is far from perfect, right? Well, ultimately, he doesn't even get his dream fulfilled of going into the land of Israel because he didn't follow exactly what God had asked. Not perfect. But if you take the time to try to understand the greatness of the man, we see him as he's the leader in taking the Jews out of Egypt. But my goal tonight was to take a step back and say, how did he become that? What was the proving ground for him to nurture that character trait? And I really truly believe that that's why the Torah specifically tells us those few stories. Because again, it's not a great historical perspective. It's missing gaps. It's missing a lot. But I'll show you that I think that there's a little bit more to this. Where can we see others? I don't think it's you. I don't think Moshe is the only one that has this trait. I think many people have this trait. And I hope that the goal will be, and that is, I can learn from it. Maybe I can't be Moses, or maybe I can't be as great as Miriam is, but I can at least work on that trait to be better for me. That's my hope. The Torah describes a little bit later. Let me see if I can find the verse itself. I cheated. I wrote down where it was.
Never do that.
I know, but I wasn't sure. It's not like it wasn't coming to me quickly, so I wrote it down when I looked it up. Okay. I'm going to get myself in trouble, but so be it. Okay. This is right around the time of giving of the Torah at Mount Sinai. About a vision that's seen. Moses, Aaron, Nadav, and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel ascended, referring to Mount Sinai. They saw the God of Israel, and this is the part that's strange. And under his feet, and again, it's allegorical, this God that has no feet, but it's a vision, okay? And under his feet was the likeness of sapphire brickwork. And it was like the essence of the heaven in purity. Super Kabbalistic, majorly mystical discussion.
Did you say impurity?
No,
or
in pause, purity. Purity.
Okay.
I only want to focus on one tiny little thing here because I don't understand most of the other stuff. There's some description here that God up in heaven, and on the flooring of it is sapphire brickwork. Okay. Most of us would kill to have a floor out of sapphire. I'd settle for marble. I'd settle for onyx. You know, some nice yellow brick road. But brickwork. What was the brickwork? So Rashi, okay, one of the classic commentators, quotes an early, early source that this was the vision that God kept, so to say, in the front of his mind all the years that the Jews were enslaved in Egypt. When I said brickwork, did anyone have the thought run through their head?
Yeah.
Right? Of what?
That's what they were making.
That's what we did as slaves. Constant making brick. And then even after Moses comes on the scene and tells Pharaoh, it's time to let him go. What does Pharaoh do? Yeah, he says, he does worse than that. I'll come back to that. But he says, no, keep the same quota, but now you go get your own raw materials.
Oh yeah, no straw.
No straw, no mortar. You're going to do this on your own now. Okay.
What was he thinking?
I'll explain that. Okay. We'll come back to it. Says Rashi that this is exactly the point. God was saying, I have kept that difficult situation of the Jews being enslaved. I've kept it in the forefront of my mind as well. Obviously, I'm not suffering in the sense of having to make the bricks and whatever it is, but I feel I get their pain. I see what the situation is. Now, what's fascinating about it is, what is the bush that God decided to show himself to, show Moshe to? In what kind of bush?
I don't know. Juniper.
So close.
I don't know.
Myrrh. Frankincense.
Okay, let's think that religion.
They have those there.
Come on, what was the order? What kind of what?
Myrtle? No.
Sandalwood.
Cactus.
You can even give me the general
Azalea. Oh, I don't know.
It's a thorn bush. It's a very thorny. It's a thorn bush, is what it's called. Which specific kind? I don't know. But why? Think about it for a moment. If, for whatever the reason, you've merited that God is going to come to you and speak to you, why would you have chosen, God, a lowly thorn bush? Let's even say it's a cacti, right?
That's how I see
it. Right? Let's even say, I don't know what it is, right? That's the, I would expect, give me some, you know,
majestic
cedar of Lebanon. Give me some cypress. Give me something that's, you know, big and tall. This little bush, don't get a thorn bush.
Well, because thorns are
it makes you
alive on the inside, but you don't come close to me on the outside.
You get distance.
They're angry.
You can't embrace the divine. There has to be some separation.
Okay, I've seen something along those lines. Very good. Right? That's really what Pam's trying to say.
There's some separation there.
He speaks for me.
Right? That while I'm talking to you, God says, while I brought the divine to you,
keep your distance.
You know, there's no hugs going on here, right? There's a certain distance. God is divine and we're not. Fine. But there's another message here.
See, I think it means that some internal fire, because it's not naturally, it doesn't have a lot of foliage or branches to burn, so the
I just think fire, it's the opposite. I was thinking the opposite. It's dry, it's perfect burning. That's what was so astounding about the whole story, because it's on fire and it's not being consumed. That's the if it's a moist, very wet green thing with foliage. It's not going
to
burn very well.
But not if it's because
oxygen. That's the point.
That's what I'm saying.
Okay, so I don't know.
Tough on the outside.
Wait, we're arguing about the same agreement.
Yes.
Apparently so.
The idea of the fact that it was something that was highly flammable, yet it was not being consumed, even though there was a fire raging within it, was clearly God saying, I got this. I have a message for you. Yeah. And it clearly caught Moshe's attention. That's why he turned to see what was so unusual about this. It should be completely consumed in no time.
Of course.
Yet it wasn't.
Burning, but it wasn't burning up.
Right. Which was crazy. Makes no sense. That's what was so miraculous about it. But what was the message being conveyed? So again, if you think along the lines of what I'm trying to convey tonight, it's the same idea. God is not going to come in the most majestic, fabulously ornate and incredible thing when in the forefront of his mind are his people suffering. I too, so to say, the fire, which is me, that burning, I'm also stuck in a lowly thorn bush. I feel that. And the time has come. Their cries have reached me to a point of where I will do something about it. There's a symbolism within that thorn bush of God saying, I feel that pain as well.
But why sapphire?
Great question. You'll have to be certified in Kabbalah first.
Well, it makes me think of the temple and all the stones and stuff that are used when, not even the temple, the tabernacle in the middle of the desert, and the uniforms of the priests and stuff with the lazis and azul and all of that. It makes me think of those colors.
But this is bricks of sapphire. I mean, I can't imagine. I mean, that's like not decorating the tabernacle with jewels. It's
right. Yeah, I'm
with you. I'm saying there's in the deep mystical realm what exactly this is referring to, and it's certainly above my pay grade, way above.
Interesting. But is the blue significant?
Of course.
Everything is significant.
You want to know why it's significant?
Well, I suspect that rather than ruby or emerald, that there's a reason it was sapphire.
I couldn't agree.
That's why I thought about the tabernacle and what the clothes were wearing, the priests were wearing, because there is that repetitive in the tent of meeting and everything with that blue color and with stones and things.
God doesn't need a reminder, right? God doesn't need a reminder. God is God.
People need the reminder.
It's for us. And this is how I think we should, you know, put some kind of a conclusion on this. I can't physically go and do something about what's going on in Ukraine. I can't physically do anything about that, right? But it should pain me. There should be a moment every day of where we acknowledge it and do whatever it is we could do. Even just taking the time to say, I feel the pain. They're suffering. I mean, the numbers are staggering. It's ridiculous. But we go about our day and it's like, okay, it was a rough day. We had a lot of work to do, right? We have to find time. We have to do something to say, I feel the pain. And I think that that is really the message of the brickwork. That doesn't need a reminder. It's that it stays in the forefront of our minds. It's something of critical importance. You say, to the other side of the world, doesn't have any impact on me unless you're driving. Right? Of course it has an impact. Gas prices.
That sapphire right here, the blue is forever.
Okay, but that's a pink.
This is blue, but that's pink. That's seltzer.
Not Tara.
Not Tara.
They tell a story about during I think it was World War I. A story about a sage who was nowhere near the war. And he went to sleep very late because he was learning and studying and he was up early. So most people didn't see exactly what his sleeping arrangements were. But a grandchild was visiting and happened to see his door open. And he saw that he was sleeping on the floor. His bed was right there, but he was sleeping on the floor. And in the morning, he asked his grandfather why, I noticed it. Why were you doing that? And his response was very simple. There are people who are suffering in a war. I don't feel comfortable being comfortable in my bed. It didn't change the outcome of the war. It didn't, but it's working on ourselves in a practical way. What can I do to feel the pain? Right? I'm not saying that we should go and become nomads and have to flee, but maybe we should hold ourselves back from a pleasure because there are people really suffering. That's what it means to not just, and I guess maybe I didn't come out as clearly as I should. There are two aspects of Moshe's greatness. Number one is that he actually observed someone else's pain. How many of us do that? If only. But then what did he do about it? He did something, something. It's a two-step process. That's what it entails. And it is a very important trait. And I think, maybe I saw it this way, but I certainly think it to be true, that that is a true mark of leadership. It's not standing on your high horse and saying, well, here's what needs to be, and then you give great instruction and great leadership, and then you close your door and you sit down to a five-course meal, and you know, and you put your feet up, and you have your brandy, and that's, if you're really going to be leading people who are in pain and stuff, do something for real. You should feel the pain a little bit. We should, not you. We should. Again, I can't change what's going on over there. Can I donate things? Yes. Can I give money? Yes. And that's my part to the best of my ability. I do say every day so far, thank God I've been able to do it, say an extra prayer every day.
I thank God that I adapted when I did.
Mm. Yeah.
They do the same thing. Because we would not be there now.
No, no way.
And I hate to be the flip side of that.
Sure enough then.
Right? The flip side of it is how many more are going to be needing adoption when this is
That is actually one of the things I've done is donated to a synagogue that's not a synagogue, but an orphanage that has primarily Jewish children who either need adoption because they don't have parents or because their parents could no longer take care of them. And in Ukraine, there is no international adoption right now. There hasn't been for many, many years. But Marcy and I both adopted from Russia. So there's no way we could go back.
I mean, I'm so proud. I mean, in my neighborhood, in my area of Baltimore, there's some really amazing people that have put together donating medical equipment. And I mean, and it's on its way. Yeah. It's on its way.
And I mean, in Israel, there is so much medical equipment and teams that are going there, as well as there's some debate, but the number of people that they are letting in and is up until very recently is better than the United States, frankly. And, you know, so I've given to like the World Food Program and World Central Kitchen and places like that.
There are wonderful organizations out there.
All over.
But I think for me, and again, this is my lesson, right? It's not just my donation. I don't feel that is sufficient. I can give whatever I can give, but it's not personally in there.
Yeah.
I have to do something where I feel it. I have to feel it. So yes, if you're donating $100,000 and you feel the pinch, I hear you. Right? And I'm not, I don't mean to make light of the fact that whatever we give is great and important. Mm. Right? But do we feel it? Are we really feeling it? Here's one example. It has nothing to do with the crisis. But here's just a basic Jewish law, right? The saddest day on the Jewish calendar is what? What day? It's Tisha B'Av. Tisha B'Av, the ninth day of the Hebrew month of Av, of where? It's the days that unfortunately we've had many, many tragedies. Temples were destroyed, World War II, there's a Spanish Inquisition throughout our history. That's always been the day. There is a halacha. It's in the code of Jewish law that if you, let's say, for example, right, that you normally sleep with two pillows when you go to bed at night, right? Tisha B'Av night, sleep with one. Does that change? Right? It doesn't change the fact that it was destroyed, right? But you know what? It became real for a moment. For one night, and then without it.
There are other restrictions.
Yeah, 100%. those are higher significance than sleeping with one pillow.
Right, but I never knew them until I started working at Shoresh.
there are that we fast, and there's a lot of things. I'm talking about something that is quote unquote minor, but it's real. Mm-hmm. To me, that's real. I have a more difficult time sleeping with one pillow than I do with two.
See, one of the very first jobs I had was looking at and writing papers for policy makers on the crisis in the Balkans and the numbers of people who were internally displaced or who have left the country in Ukraine is multiple times bigger than what was in the Balkans. And watching the response, particularly in Europe, to this versus the crisis in the Balkans, it's like a 180-degree turn, because at a certain point, nobody wanted to take more refugees from the Balkans. And we're talking like the highest number was like 800,000 in Germany. We're talking in Ukraine, much larger than that. Mm-hmm. And so the response is thankfully so much very, very different. The difference is that the job I'm in now, I'm not directly supporting policymakers who can do that, who can change things. And that makes me sad. So I find other ways to sort of make a difference.
But I get what you're saying. It makes the pillow thing.
It's such a little thing. It's such a minor thing.
But is it really?
But that's my point. No, in the scope of things, it doesn't change anything other than it became a little more real.
But
it's hard to relate to.
But
it.
I would say maybe every day. It's not one day, no pillow or what, you know. It's, I mean, every day, 24 hours, this is going on.
I'm not saying
there is suffering in so much of the world all the time, even when it's not on the TV.
I don't disagree. Do you know that I can, whatever, the names won't mean anything to you, but great sages that passed away within the last, you know, couple of years, right? One in particular, someone again offered him a dessert or whatever it was for ice cream. And he said, no. He said, no. He said, someone asked him why. He says, because that's a pleasure I don't need in my life when there's so much else in this world.
He hasn't had peanut butter.
Okay. Notice I didn't use myself as the example.
What's a Rabbi Sachs?
Right?
Right.
I don't know.
Because like Rabbi Sachs.
You know what I'm saying? You're right. But it's a matter of taking. I know, but I'm saying it's a matter of us taking a step back. Listen, we are, thank God, we live in this country. Let's not, with all of its warts, the fact of the matter is we're free. We're free to do as we please. This could never happen in other countries. What we have right now, getting together in your home, talking about Judaism, other places, you can't have this. So don't, you know, it's a broken system. I don't like this group. I don't like that. Fine. But we are in the land of the free, the land of plenty. Plenty. There's a lot. There's a lot we could do to minimize in our own lives, even if it's, you're right, it should be every day. But human nature is such that if you do it every day, it becomes just another.
Well, that's true, but so, you have to work for the intention.
I'm with
that
you.
That doesn't mean that you don't say brachot every day.
Agreed.
That too can be, you say it so that you don't, it's not rote to just accept those things and not appreciate them.
Agreed.
But if you say it, then it becomes, but.
So
you have to hold that line. You have bring kavana, right?
I totally agree. And yes, if it means that it means something every day, then great. That's what we should do. There should be something. If nothing else, ladies and gentlemen, you walk out of here tonight saying, okay, I could be better. I could be better. I can do something here in my little tiny corner of the world regarding the conflict. I have to decide on my own how I'm going to incorporate it personally.
But it's not like there's two parts of it. Like, what can I do to help and what can I do to feel it?
Correct.
It's both of those.
That's correct.
Parts of it. It's not just one and it's not just the other.
Correct. That's correct. That is correct. Yes, ma'am.
So
that 40 years wandering when Moses had his, when he got really angry, when he
didn't
listen, or yeah. I mean, that this is just about how he became a hero, not about, I mean, he's still a hero because he makes it through the whole journey, but it makes him look really human too, because
he smashed the tablets after the gold.
Yeah, I mean, that's all okay about being a hero. Right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Heroes are human.
Absolutely.
Also.
That's correct.
Unless you're God, of course.
But, or underdog.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned God getting mad at him at the burning bush because he's not willing to take up the mantle. He's trying to push it off. With the story where he strikes the rock twice, is he mad at him because he has doubts, or he's mad at him for trying to take authority? Or I've read different things.
Correct. I was just going to say, you can go in many directions there as to what was the mistake that he made there. Right? Even just referring to the Jewish people as the rebellious ones, you know, you bunch of impishtim and the wanzia heads.
Wow.
Right? By lashing out against the... That's, according to some commentators, that was the big sin. Some of it because he didn't follow exactly. There's many, 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 many different takes on it. But going back to your point, whatever it was a human mistake. He's not infallible. There is nobody. I say this all the time. This book, if you read it, right, we do very little right. We do a lot wrong. This book was either written by God or an anti-Semite. I'm serious.
That's a good title. It's trying.
We're all human.
It's trying to mean
Abraham, Sarah, Isaac. You go from the beginning, Adam, all the way to where we are today. There's nobody.
Multiple needs.
There's nobody that has that stat. It's impossible.
Yeah.
We're all human, and we make mistakes. Even the best of us.
And the book describes all of us as having different needs, but also different parts of the story, so that it's picking and choosing in some ways the stories, but also trying to balance the Jews and their belief in one God and all of the surrounding communities that had different beliefs, and trying to sort of mush it all together sometimes is how I feel. Because it's like, especially when you read like the early prophets, and it's like, this person did this, this, and this. And then they started praying to multiple gods and God didn't like it. And then they don't learn from that lesson. And it's like, okay, so.
Are we any different?
Yeah, I was going to say, that is how we are.
That's exactly
maybe that's why it's actually written down.
Right. Versus, you know, making it all look pretty and put a bow on it.
We should learn from our mistakes. We are supposed to learn from history, but we try each day to do it a little bit better.
Yes.
That's the best.
Yes.
The best we can do.
It's part of the point for us to get through the book and learn about all of our mistakes and do better, so that the Messiah comes? Is that?
I don't know if I would necessarily link the two.
Because we all have to get it right before.
Nah.
No? Thank goodness.
There's a trap door somewhere. There's an exit stage left somewhere.
But I thought that, you know, if all the Jews observed Shabbos the way it's supposed
to. Yes. There is a that's piece of Talmud right. that says that if all the Jews were to observe Shabbos, then yes, it would automatically bring the Messiah. But that's not the only way. That's not the only way it can come.
Okay.
In any sense that begins with if all the Jews stop right there.
I mean, it's like
that's a terrible joke. That's the terrible joke. The guy who's been on a deserted island. Oh, come on, I don't know this joke. It's one of the oldest.
Yeah.
He's on a deserted island. He got shipwrecked, whatever. He's on a deserted island. He's there for who knows how long. And finally, he's rescued. And he was so proud of what it, you know, that he had done there. So he takes the rescuers on a tour of what it is. And they ask him, what's this? He says, well, that's the market. And I would go out and get the fruits and vegetables, and I would put it here. And what's this? That's my hut. That's my home. And what's this? Well, that's the synagogue that I pray in. And what's that? Well, that's the synagogue. I'm never going to pray.
Yeah.
Is the purpose of studying Torah?
I'm sorry, what?
Is the purpose of studying Torah from a, like a yeshiva perspective? Is it to learn about it, or is it to teach others how we can all get it right to make that? Because isn't that the goal?
Well, there's two. Again, I don't think they're mutually exclusive. Each person has the responsibility to learn the Torah. That's incumbent on every person. Yeshiva, not yeshiva, male, female, doesn't matter. We all have that responsibility to learn the Torah. That's a mitzvah. It's one of the 613 commandments.
But is it to learn it so that we know it, or is it to learn it to learn from our mistakes? I guess
it doesn't have to be only to learn from our mistakes. The Torah is the book of God's wisdom, if you can use that terminology, right? That in and of itself, studying it, is what God wants. You're studying his wisdom. You're studying God's wisdom. Now, obviously, it's meant to be put into practice.
Right, it's not
just and it's meant not just to be an intellectual and academic pursuit. It's meant to be internalized. It's meant to incorporated in that also is to make sure others learn it also because you want everyone to do it. But they're not necessarily, not everyone is meant to be a teacher.
Right.
You know, by default, unfortunately, you guys got stuck with me. Right. Not everyone is meant to do that. But that doesn't mean they have no less of a mitzvah to study Torah.
But it's the studying and the doing. They're both.
Yes, Judaism is not a spectator sport. That is true. Nike is correct. Just do it. That's correct.
Okay.
But the two go hand in hand.
Yes.
But I just want to, I don't want someone to think that it's in order that I can teach it or that I do it. There are parts of the Torah, right? Leon brought us up, right? There are certain parts of the Torah that are not applicable today, right? There's a whole section in the book of Leviticus that doesn't have quote unquote relevance today. Mm-hmm. I can't bring sacrifices. I don't have offerings like that, right? The question then is, why do I study it? What's the relevancy that I could make? That's a good question, right? But it's still studying Torah. Mm-hmm. And you get full credit for studying God's Torah, even on those sections that seem to be not relevant today. If you're asking me, what should a person focus on in a priority listing? I wouldn't put that at the top, mm-hmm. right? I'd start with stuff that we could put into practice because it makes it a little bit more meaningful. Mm-hmm. But it's all Torah, right?
Okay.
I'm going to turn off the recording and I'll tell you a story. I just don't want this going anywhere. Ladies, you can stay on.